Thanks, Scott. Next up is Oliver Gyken at Temple University, and has been doing some really pioneering research in the earliest of cinema, especially around discourses and representations of science, especially through popular science films. So please welcome Oliver.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks to all of you. I'd like to begin with a few brief remarks about the genesis of this paper. Initially, I was going to talk about some of Roman Vishniak's films. Vishniak was, by all accounts, a remarkable person, a renowned documentary photographer and art historian. He was also an accomplished scientist, specializing in marine microbiology. He made advances in time-lapse cinematography, light interruption photography, and photomicroscopy. And his research and popular science films, made from the 1950s until the 1970s, are housed here at the University of South Carolina. Since the archives here have been in the throes of moving recently, I wasn't able to take a look at video copies of some of Vishniak's catalog of hundreds of titles. What I noticed just from browsing the titles, however, was that many of the subjects of Vishniak's films were identical to titles of research and popular science films that had been made half a century or more earlier. So, for example, one of Vishniak's subjects, the seahorse, also appears in the catalogs of the Eclair and Pathé companies in the early 1910s, and then again in Jean Penlevé's L'Hippocampe of 1934. Another of Vishniak's subjects, the frog, features in the catalogs of the Charles Urban Company beginning in 1903 and 4, when F. Martin Duncan headed the company's popular scientific filmmaking unit. And the same animal is the subject of a film later when Percy Smith takes over the science film duties at Urban. Eclair and Pathé, again, also make films about frogs. Certain more exotic microscopic creatures also feature in the catalogs of multiple companies, such as the Volvox Globator, the Rotifer, and so on. Now, there are many examples of these repetitions, not only in Vishniak's filmography and not just concerning animals, but also in the physical sciences, magnetism, for instance, botany, etc. Now, of course, the practice of borrowing plots and subjects is a familiar practice in fiction film. And at times, I think something similar is going on in the nonfiction realm, as when, for instance, smaller producers, rival producers, copied Pathé's successful popular science film productions starting in the early 1910s. But there's another sense in which these repetitions seem less motivated, less contingent. There seems to be a level of repetition that occurs across time in the absence of a direct tradition. Vishniak, in other words, seems to be taking up earlier filmmaker subjects without any sign of the transmission of a tradition. Now, I say seems, of course, because without a better sense of the film's actual representational strategies, as well as a better sense of Vishniak's history as a filmmaker, which might well have involved the study of his predecessors, it's impossible to confirm my suspicion that there is a form of discontinuous continuity in the popular science film, a manner in which certain types of films are being remade over and over without a sense of what's gone before. This, at least, is the path that my thoughts were leading down in preparation for the initial version of this talk. And so, although my focus has shifted somewhat, I would still like to launch this question of influence and tradition, which seems a crucial one to me since these films are so frequently seen as anonymous, constituting a kind of cultural dump from which a few intrepid explorers may now sample, but which for the majority of cinema history remains a wasteland. Vishniak's films inherit a long tradition of popular scientific filmmaking that continues into the present and stretches back beyond the beginning of cinema. So in the time remaining, I'd like to consider some of the early examples of this tradition, beginning with another creature, the octopus, that has also figured in the filmographies of Penlevé, Pathé, as well as the earliest company to produce a coherent and sustained popular science film catalog, the Charles Urban Company. Through a contextualization of this film, I will also introduce the recurring motif that I mentioned in the paper's title, that of animal violence. And before showing the first film, I just want to pause for a moment to thank, maybe I guess magnify, Dan Strebel for the amazing speed and good humor with which he responded to my last-minute requests for archival materials. And of course, my thanks as well to those other invisible operators, James and Luke, in the booth. Can we have the first film, please?
Mm-hmm.
This film, The Octopus, was part of a program entitled The Denizens of the Deep, which was added to the program of the Alhambra Theatre in London on the 19th of October, 1903. It replaced the program The Unseen World, which had run for 2 months at the Alhambra. In the 1904 urban catalog, Denizens consists of 14 films: Sea Brim, The Pollock, Sea Mullet and Weaver, The Dogfish, Conger Eel, Skate, Edible Crab, King or Horseshoe Crab, The Lobster, The Crayfish, Spider Crab, Hermit Crab, and Ship Barnacles, and The Octopus. The total length of the program was 500 feet. A promotional title slide gives an indication of how Urban wanted to represent the series. And if I could get the PowerPoint. The microscope in the image serves as a link to the previous series, The Unseen World, some of whose films remained on the updated program, while the figures of the deep sea diver and the octopus represent the new elements of the show. The circle of light that recalls the aperture of a lantern slide frames the image of the octopus. This circle has a kind of an odd effect, however, making the octopus simultaneously seem present in the same space as the diver while also separating it from him. If we read the image as representing two separate moments in time, the circle of light could be related to the diver's flashlight, a possibility that underscores the slide's suggestion of the series of films as an underwater exploration. This suggestion was rather fanciful, though, since the films were shot at the Brighton Aquarium, and true underwater cinematography was exceedingly rare until the development of specialized camera and breathing equipment in the 1920s. In keeping with the octopus's role as the showstopper, the catalog description emphasizes the animal's frightening aspects, and these are the two descriptions from Urban's catalogs of this film that we've just seen. Because it was both part of this 500-foot series and also marketed as a film on its own, exhibitors wanted to mix and match titles on as they saw fit. The octopus is the veritable dragon of the deep. All day long, he hides up in the dark caves and crannies in the rocks, and at night comes out in search of victims. He has the power of blushing all the colors of the rainbow. Each of his long arms is clothed with 100 powerful suckers, and his strong jaws are like the beak of a parrot. Should he get the worst of it in a fight, he suddenly ejects a quantity of black inky fluid in the face of his astonished foe, and under the cover of the dark turbid water beats a hasty retreat. And then this is the second description. The octopus is one of the dragons of the deep. We see him at home amongst his natural surroundings of rocks and sunken wreckage. During the hours of daylight, he remains quietly tucked away in a cave, looking out for stray victims that may pass near his haunts. But as night draws on, comes forth and swims backwards with powerful strokes through the water, looking for his evening meal. Armed with a great circle of waving sucker-pad limbs and cruel, powerful jaws shaped like a gigantic parrot's beak, he is indeed a formidable and evil-looking creature. Now we can see the frame enlargement reproduced in the catalog that shows how the photography's strong top lighting and black background accentuated sinister aspects of the program's star. And I have to admit, I had never seen the film projected before. I knew that it existed. And so I had always assumed that this image, which is in the catalog, is taken from the film, but obviously it's not. An interesting, lot of interesting disparities between the film we saw and the descriptions of it. Photographing the new program presented considerable difficulties, as the following preface to the individual title description of Denizens attests. Under the rubric of Marine Studies, a unique series of animated pictures of marine life photographed by Mr. F. Martin Duncan, the description reads, "By courtesy of the management of the Brighton Aquarium, these studies of marine life form one of the most remarkable and interesting series of animated pictures ever produced. Great care and attention has been devoted to the minutest details so as to render these pictures as perfect as possible and to show the various creations in their most characteristic attitudes and occupations. The disheartening and multitudinous difficulties that have to be contended against in photographing the sly and nervous denizens of the deep must be personally encountered to be fully appreciated, for their name is legion. And no sooner is one difficulty overcome than another arises to take its place. It is only by the exertion of that great patience and quiet determination to conquer all difficulties which has enabled us to so successfully take this unique series of pictures of marine life. Now, the idea that filming animals requires an exceptional amount of perseverance is a familiar refrain in accounts of wildlife filmmaking. And although the passage does not reveal the exact nature of the difficulties, the phrase sly and nervous provides a useful clue, I think. A major problem that Duncan must have encountered was the reaction of the animals to the strong lights necessary for acceptable exposures, and octopi are particularly photosensitive. Whether, however, the animals depicted in Denizens seemed at home is, of course, open to dispute. Some of the show's reviews were impressed with the results. One newspaper account wrote, "One marvels at the ingenuity and patience with which the naturalist must have waited for his opportunity to catch his subjects in their characteristic moments. For in the aquarium they seem immediately to be at home, which could not have been actually the case. And the audience wait for the climax of a fight between lobsters with almost bated breath, and almost feel the clammy arms of the rapidly moving octopus." This review uses similar language, characteristic moments, as the catalog, but its approving estimation of the scenes seems to occur against its better judgment. The subjects seem immediately to be at home, but this could not have actually been the case. In other words, the reviewer's appreciation for the series is due in part to an awareness of the difficulties involved in the production. What one viewer praised is used by another viewer as evidence of aspects of the film that detract from the quality of the presentation. This is also a contemporaneous review of this series, Denizens of the Deep. "The series of bioscope pictures of spiders, frogs, chameleon, and other fearful wild fowl, which has proved so great a success at the Alhambra, was last night preceded by a set of views of the Denizens of the Deep. Living pictures are shown of crabs, lobsters, eels, skate, and an octopus, in their habit as they live, in an aquarium. At least it would thus appear, for the various fishes and crustacea descend into the disk of light from the top and behave as though they had been shot into a tank to which they were previously unaccustomed. And they find not only a strange home, but apparently strange company, for differences and disputes are numerous. Of the natural history pictures, which have already been described, those of the worm-eating toads, the chameleons flipping their food, and the spider fight remain. The new views are clever and interesting, but they tend to confirm the view that when strange animals are neither eating or breeding, they are fighting." Here, the evaluation of the series being filmed in an aquarium is decidedly more skeptical. Something else that emerges in this account of Denizens is that Duncan obviously felt it necessary to include certain types of scenes, the slow-paced and incident-poor reality of observing wildlife, even in a zoo or an aquarium, had to be replaced with moments of excitement, such as animal tussles. The description of animals being, quote, shot into a tank to which they were previously unaccustomed suggests that impatience and subterfuge may have won out over the, quote, great patience and quiet determination that the catalog copy mentions. These artlessly staged battles, however, are absolutely typical of popular science films. Jennifer Peterson, who's presenting in the next panel, will have more to say about battling animals. I'd like to distinguish, if it's possible, between two forms of this film. Those where animal fights are staged, which begin practically at the beginning of cinema, and films where the violence is visited upon animals by humans. Although in the former type of film, the issue of staging, of course, only removes humans from the equation to a slight degree. And I wonder if there is any meaningful difference between killing a rat directly or placing it into a terrarium with a scorpion that will subsequently sting it to death. As Paula Ahmad has noted, as fascinating and wonderful as early cinema is, its position towards others, be they human or animal, presents problems that we have only begun to confront. Emblematic of the uneasy fascination with which the popular science film is teeming is the following film by Pathé from 1911. The titles and intertitles are in German because the print is part of the Joie collection at the National Film and Television Archive, and I'll read translations as they come up. This film is part of the remarkable surge in the production of popular science films in France at the beginning of the teens, which was spurred by various things: a turn to the uplift discourse surrounding the cinema, the initial popularity of Jean Commandant's films for Pathé, and Pathé's desire to establish new categories of product. This film, which is typical of these films, contains much that is interesting, but there is one extraordinary moment, which I will leave for you to discover. So the title, which won't appear, I think, is The Guests of the Ocean: Lobsters, Sea Spiders, and Crabs. This image shows us how the armored animals that live at the bottom of the sea are caught. The lobster is an edible crustacean that can be caught using a dead fish as bait. The catch during low tide. In order to catch crabs and sea spiders, one pulls an old net slowly along the bottom of the sea. What the net brings to the light of day. Sea spiders, which live in great depths, their armor is corrugated in order to resist the great pressure. Seen from below. The Maya, another sea spider that lives in great depths. The movements of this animal are extremely slow. the crabs. The largest of the crabs, the rock or edible crab. Its claws. The gills through which the animal breathes are found in the rear section of the body. The same crab in water. The power of its claws. The crabs are very aggressive. So although this film ends with a scene of combat between the crabs, the moment I feel that moment I think pales in comparison to the shot where the hand reaches in from outside of the frame to break apart the crab's claw. I'd initially intended to show you this shot in isolation, but because of the added time, it would have been a shame not to see the whole film. What strikes me about this shot is not only the graphic violence, but the gratuity of that violence. Nothing other, I think, than a morbid curiosity seems to motivate showing the breaking of the claw, if it was even, in fact, necessary. And there's something about the logic of appendages in that shot that is disorienting, how the human hand is at once vulnerable, bleeding, but also armed with pincers of its own. A weird displacement then kind of happens that humanizes, in a way, the crab claw. Now, I'd like to juxtapose this shot with a nightmarishly memorable sequence from film Ist, Gustav Deutsch's film, whose centerpiece is footage from the film Bietis Arietans Beute erwerbt durch Giftbiss, a film about how the puff adder kills its prey. So if I could get the video clip, please. point to two related issues that seem both particularly relevant to the types of film we're considering here: death and a particular way of reading and dealing with film footage. In André Bazin's essay on Pierre Braunberger's The Bullfight from 1951, he focuses on the experience of the bullfight and the representation of death, arguing that that film provides, quote, its metaphysical kernel, death. The tragic ballet of the bullfighter turns around the presence and permanent possibility of death, that of the animal and the man. That is what makes The Ring into something more than a theater stage. Death is played on it. Bazin's constellation of animals, man, cinema, and death suggests another dimension to him, to his philosophy, which is often, albeit increasingly less frequently, thought of as naive realism. Because far from a valorization of the cinema as a vivifying medium capable of reproducing a profilmic reel, a more careful and sympathetic reading of Bazin reveals how centrally he locates the cinema's relation to death. And in the sequence from Film Ist, does anyone identify with the snake? For me, at least, the power of the sequence comes from how it allows for an imagining of the experience of the moment of dying. Finally, by considering these moments in isolation, I wonder whether we are performing a certain type of violence on them ourselves, and whether that violence is necessarily negative. Both moments contain unusual visual power. As Tom Gunning writes in an essay on Film Ist, they, quote, twitch like amputated limbs, displaying their unique features divorced from contextual meaning. This decontextualization, this severing of the moment from the rest of the film, goes a considerable way towards reestablishing, or at least concentrating, the cinema's power to reveal other worlds, those profound transformations of habitual perception that the camera brings to light, and that Scott spoke of so well just a few minutes ago. As Siegfried Krakauer writes of the power of magnification in The Theory of Film, quote, any huge close-up reveals new and unsuspected formations of matter. Skin textures are reminiscent of aerial photographs. Eyes turn into lakes of volcanic craters. Such images blow up our environment in a double sense. They enlarge it literally, and in so doing, they blast the prison of conventional reality, opening up expanses which we have explored at best in dreams before. Thank you.